no idea how much better your thoughtful, loving, and intelligent words have made me feel. About everything. God, I love you. Kiss, 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 kiss. Friday, 25th of March, 2011. Oh, God, Jim. Don't do this to me now, darling, please. I need you now, so much. I feel so raw, like someone's peeled off all my skin and left me out on the beach. It's been over a week since I heard from you. I can't bear it. You've never gone this long before without writing. Oh, Christ, are you okay? You're not hurt, are you? You're not in trouble. I just can't be on my own right now. I opened Pandora's box, darling. I opened it for you, and I'm glad I did. It had to happen, but I'm not dealing with it very well. And I'm not well. I'm really not well. I can't even think about making it to the docks. I can barely move. Please, Jim, write to me. Anything, even if it's bad. Please. Kiss, 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 kiss. Thursday, 31st of March, 2011. So, is that it, then, Jim? Are we done? Did you finally tire off me? Oh, God, I don't blame you. How could I? I mean, look at me. I've been wearing the same clothes for over a week. I smell, Jim. I know I do. Of illness and old hair and dehydration. I'm losing the plot, Jim. Where are you? Kiss, 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 kiss. Wednesday, 6th of April, 2011. I can't be here anymore. I hate this house now I've let Reese back into it. I'm tired, and I'm cold, and I'm dirty, and I'm coming to see you. I'll find my way to Gateshead somehow. Please be there for me. I've lost my way. I'm half gone. I'll see you in a few hours. Don't try and stop me. Kiss, 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 kiss. Chapter 17. April 2011. The heat wave finally broke on Good Friday, and as the bank holiday weekend began, more people arrived at the house. Pandora from Corfu, freshly divorced and terribly brown. Sophie and Maddie, Lorna and her new husband, even Ben. The house was filled with people. The pavement outside parked up with cars. Shift systems were devised to take things to the landfill, to take other things to charity shops. Lorna's husband, an antiques dealer, usefully ferreted out things of worth. Pandora and Megan led the cleaning team of Molly, Maddie, Sophie and Rory. Bethan sat sedately and sorted through the boxes of smaller objects, sifting through for things worth keeping. Ben collapsed boxes and took them to be recycled. They all sat each evening in grubby clothes, eating at the huge kitchen table, uncorking cheap wine, eating bread and fancy cheeses from the fancy cheese shop in the village. Ben played guitar. Molly moved the focus of her attentions from Rory to Ben. They talked, they gossiped, they laughed, they cried. It was one of the best Easter weekends Megan could remember. And then it was over. Ben, Maddie, Lorna and her husband headed back to work. Sophie went back to college. Pandora had things to do in London. By Monday evening, it was just the five of them again. And by Monday evening, the hallway had been cleared. The staircase had been cleared, the living room had been cleared, and the rooms that had once made up Colin's half of the house had been cleared. Carpets had been ripped up, rolled up and taken away, revealing untouched marquetry parquet underneath. All the old lampshades had gone and been replaced with white paper balloons from the Asda megastore. The curtains had been taken away and burned, windows scrubbed and vinegared, paintwork bleached back to white. The two tatty sofas in the living room were disguised under white throws. Two nice pieces of walnut cabinetry polished back to life, and everything else taken to the tip. Megan walked through the house now, Molly following behind. It bore no relationship to the house she'd grown up in. It was so subdued and empty, so calm and elegant. The rooms felt enormous without the ever-present sacks of crap and boxes of clutter, the shelves loaded with ornaments and paperwork, broken clocks and obsolete party invitations, the patterned rugs and bits of ethnic tat. The walls looked so blank and broad without the higgledy-piggledy arrangements of junk shop art and framed photos and posters torn from magazines, all randomly adhered to the wall with blue tack. The staircase was so wide. The light through the windows so bright. As she walked, Megan realized that even before the awful events of Easter 1991, this house had been a depository for all of Lorelei's deepest buried issues and emotional unrest. She had wanted, as she said to Jim in Gateshead, to give her children the childhood she hadn't had. A childhood without secrets, without resentment. But even before Reese had subverted the mother-child relationship and turned her world on its head, she had been building up to this, piece by piece, minute by minute. If it hadn't been Reese, it would have been something else. Because the damage had been done long before that day, long before any of them were even born. And so, in the end, it had been no one's fault. No one's fault at all. It wasn't Lorelei's parents' fault, or the fault of the man who'd raped her mother, or of God above for taking away their baby daughter before she'd drawn her first breath. It wasn't Rory's fault. It wasn't Bethan's fault. It wasn't Colin's fault. It certainly wasn't Lorelei's fault. Poor, poor Mum. All those years carrying that burden alone. It was life. One of those things. Somewhere along the line, a seed had been sown in Reese's little heart, maybe even in the womb. And that seed had grown into something completely unconnected to any of them. For years, they'd all let the guilt eat away at them, and their family. But now it was gone, cut out and disposed of, like a tumour in an operating theatre. Now they were free to go on, to be healthy, to love. Now they could be a family again. At this thought, Rory appeared at the top of the stairs, his dirty blonde hair on end, his skinny-ribbed tattooed chest bare and hairless. "Here," he said, raising his arms out from his sides. "Here am I, standing at the top of the stairs. And there are you, standing at the bottom. And look at all this space that lies between us. All this clean, sane, beautiful space. Isn't it amazing?" Megan blinked at her brother. He looked happy. Happy, the way he used to be. As though he was the most popular boy in the school again. "Yes," she said. "It really, really is." From Jim Lipton at yahoo.co.uk to Megan Rose Lithington Bird at yahoo.co.uk, RoryBird2 at hotmail.com, Bethanbird at hotmail.co.uk. Saturday, 30th of April, 2011. "Dear Megan, and all the many, 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 many of you, I just wanted to write and say how much I loved meeting you all yesterday. I was terrified coming down,
as you can imagine, especially so soon after getting out of prison. It was all a bit of a whirlwind, from release to home, to getting your email, to taking on board what had happened to Laurie, to the funeral, and I feel as though my feet have barely touched the ground. The service was beautiful, truly. Your mother would have loved it. I never met Lorelei, but I felt I knew her so well from our almost daily emails. She was always so honest with me. She never hid a thing from me. It makes me feel so terribly guilty that I should have hidden from her the fact that I had that court appointment. I don't know what stopped me from mentioning it. Suppose I was scared of losing her. Which is crazy, as she was always so accepting of me and my many flaws. Anyway, I think I'd been in denial myself about the court hearing. Lorelei wasn't in me life when I got the date through, and it seemed such a long time away. And my solicitor had told me I had a very strong case. We were expecting a fine. Possibly some community service. I thought I'd be home an hour later. I mean, drunk and disorderly, how bad could it be? No criminal damage, no assault. No drink driving, just being a leery, awful tosspot in the wrong place, at the wrong time. Such a harsh sentence. And because of that, I wasn't here for your blessed mother when she needed me. I will never forgive either myself or the magistrate, but mainly myself. And to that end, I wanted to say how grateful I was to you and all your family for the warm welcome you all extended to me yesterday. I do not feel I deserved it, not in least. I know you've read the emails between myself and your mother, so you know how she felt about you all, how much she loved you all, how proud she was of all of you, and how hard she found it to come to terms with all the damage that had been inflicted over the years. She blamed herself for most of it, but hopefully I went some way to helping her see that it wasn't her fault. Thank you, also, for taking me to see your mother's house. I always had such a burning curiosity about it. I used to watch all these shows about hoarding, you know, trying to get a better insight into Laurie's syndrome. I even read a couple of books. I so wanted to help her. I thought we had all the time in the world. I was taking it slowly. Baby steps, as your mother would have said. But we didn't have all the time in the world. We had 5 months in the end. And of course, by the time I saw her house, you'd cleared it. But thank you for showing me the photos. Such a fascinating record of such an extraordinary process. Anyway, I've blathered on for much longer than I intended. I hope you don't mind if I stay in touch. I won't bombard you with stuff, just Lorelei was such a huge part of me life, and now she's gone, there's this big hole. And I know she'd want me to keep a benevolent eye on you all. Well, I think she would. She was halfway to doing it herself, you know, when she got ill. That's the real tragedy. She was halfway to remembering how to be a mummy again. Take care. All of you. I hope you'll write and let me know when Beth's baby arrives. Actually, I just hope you'll write. All the best. And if I may, all affection, Jim Lipton.
Epilogue. June 2011. The people carrier was full. Megan and Bill in the front, Molly and the three boys in the back. It was one of those sad June days that bore no relation to the fantasy of June brought to mind during the winter months. They were listening to Radio 1, Moves Like Jagger by Maroon 5, and like some advertiser's dream of a modern relaxed family, they were all singing along together, especially to the parts. They tumbled out of the car a few minutes later and onto the pavement outside the birdhouse, halfway laughing, full of pent-up energy and gladness in the moment. The boys immediately started punching each other and chasing each other up and down the narrow pavement. Megan called at them to be careful, that the cars drove through the village way too fast. From the back of the car, she and Bill pulled out three matching bags and numerous gifts wrapped in pink. They were, as ever, the travelling circus, creating havoc and noise wherever they went. "Why is my family so loud?" Megan complained, bringing down the back door. checking there were no heads or fingers in the way first. Stanley shrugged.
Because you made us, he said.
Right, well, listen. When we get inside, there is going to be a very, very tiny little baby and a very nervous first-time mother who will think that loud noises can kill babies. So I want you all, and that includes you, Stanley, to behave in a reasonable and sensible manner. Okay?
Okay, they replied in unison. Less out of obedience than from the knowledge that feigning obedience got their mother off their backs for a minute.
Megan appraised the house. It still took her aback, even on this, her third visit since Easter. Such a pretty house. Bethan had bought planters in beautiful Cotswold shades of duck egg and sage, and there was now a display of lavender and thyme on the sills. They'd been nicked in under an hour on her London street, she mused. Rory had fixed the garden gate and painted it white. It should have been sage, Megan thought to herself, or soft dove grey, but she left the thought firmly where it belonged, inside her head. She took Bill's hand in hers, and together she and her travelling circus headed up the garden path. Rory answered the door. He'd grown his shaved hair out, and it suited him.
"Come in, come in," he said. "Welcome to the House of Shitty Nappies, excuse my language," he apologised to the boys, who all shrugged, unfazed.
Rory was living in Colin's side of the house. He'd replaced the stud wall himself. Megan had no idea how or when her brother had picked up so many manly skills. She assumed it was during his time on the commune in Spain. And Bethan was living on Lorelei's side, with four bedrooms to herself. And her baby.
"Where is she? Where is she?"
she asked, aching at some very deep, fundamental level to meet this new person.
"She's in bed," said Rory. "They're in bed. She's having a baby moon."
"A what?"
"It was my idea," he said. "Well, actually, it was one of the women at the commune. She was trying to persuade Kaylee into doing it when she was having tea, but Kaylee wasn't having any of that. What, lying about in bed on my skinny arse all day with a baby? I'd go nuts. But I always thought it sounded like a great idea, so I talked Beth into it."
He held out his hands for bags and led everyone through the house. The kitchen was so cosy. The sun was shining through the leaded windows and casting rainbows about the place. There was a half-read newspaper on the table, mugs in the sink, a pot of yellow butter open on the counter, baby grows drying on the arga, and the scrubbed flagstones were warm underfoot. Beth had put pink gingham curtains at the windows, and the room smelled of toast and coffee. The boys raced upstairs to their room. It was Reese's old room, finally exercised, finally just a room again. Megan had bought two sets of bunks and paid for the room to be painted Farrow and Ball Cook's Blue. Bill stayed downstairs to help Rory make tea for everyone, and Molly and Megan squirted Milton antibacterial hand gel into their palms and tiptoed quietly up the stairs to the room that had once been Lorelei and Colin's, and then Lorelei and Vicky's, and then just Lorelei's. Bethan had gone to town on this room once it had finally been emptied. She'd papered it with baby pink rosebuds and curtained it with cream silk. She'd bought a brass bed from a local auction and clothed it with antique lace and satin eiderdowns. She'd painted all her mother's wardrobes and her dressing table in cream and carpeted the floorboards with pastel sheepskins and shagpile rugs. But she'd left some of Lorelei's touches, too. The trio of cameos of fat-bottomed cherubs in porcelain frames, a few gilt-framed oil paintings of indeterminate heritage, a couple of fussy bugle-bead-trimmed table lamps. Megan could not have stood for it. She'd have wanted it gone, every last shred of the hellhole that this room had once been. But it wasn't her room. It was Bethan's room. And it was lovely. She'd been so proud of it.
"My first real room," she'd said last time Megan had visited.
"What about your room in Sydney?" Bethan had sighed, her hand touching a small perspex cabinet on the windowsill which housed a small pink pebble and the handwritten note from Vicky. "That wasn't a room. It was a stage set. A doll's house.
It was where I lived when I was pretending to be a person. Now Megan knocked gently on the door.
Come in.
She and Molly exchanged a small smile, and then they stepped inside. And there she was, the newest bird. She was tiny, under 7 pounds, much smaller than she'd looked in the photos Beth had been texting her, and with a full head of dark hair. Beth sat cross-legged on the bed in a cream-embroidered smock that Megan recognised as one of Lorelei's, unearthed during the clear-out, and grey leggings. The baby lay in the nest created between her legs, in a pale grey baby grow with pink spots on it. She was wide awake, and the two of them were just staring at each other. Bethan looked up at Megan and Molly and smiled.
Look, she said. Look at her. Isn't she amazing?
They moved closer, barely making a sound. The whole tableau was so excruciatingly, mesmerizingly perfect, Megan could not bear to mar it in any way.
Oh, my God, she whispered, resting the palm of her germ-free hand against the baby's crown. Oh, Beth, she is beautiful.
Molly stared down at the baby, awestruck.
Oh, God, she said. She's so tiny. She's so precious.
I know, said Beth. I know.
Megan felt that familiar ache in her lower abdomen, that keening and calling of parts of herself over which she had no control. But no, she thought. No. No more babies. Here they were now. Here they all were. Beth was surrounded by all the things she needed during her baby moon. Liter bottles of water, muslins, nappies, wipes, creams, cards, flowers, clothes, books, a laptop, and a phone. She had that aura of glorious tiredness of the first-time mother, the mother who has nobody else to care for but her baby and herself. She looked beautiful. You look amazing, Meg said, cradling the baby in her arms, perched on the edge of the bed. Are you getting any sleep?
Tons, said Beth. I'm feeding her in my sleep. I just roll over when she grizzles. Bam, boob in mouth.
Molly shuddered gently and smiled grimly. Megan said, Oh, you're co-sleeping. Beth said,
Yeah, I mean, where else would she sleep?
And Megan said nothing, because none of her babies had ever slept in her bed, because that would have been a bed made to lie in. She smiled instead and said, Have you got a name yet? The baby had been the baby for 3 days now, and Megan was growing impatient.
Yes, said Beth, I do.
Molly and Megan looked at her expectantly. Elsa Athena Rose, she said. What do you think? Athena for Mum's sister. Beth nodded. I love it, she said. There was a knock at the door, and Rory and Bill came in with trays of tea and the biscuits that Megan and Molly had made together that morning in Tufnell Park. Rory sat on the other side of the bed and stroked Elsa's hair. Bill stood by Megan's side and smiled down at her.
Well done, Beth, he said. Well done. She's absolutely superb. Really.
Then the three boys came in, primed by someone, Bill, she assumed, to be very quiet indeed. They tiptoed in, one behind the other, and then the room was full of them. Her family. She heard a car pull up outside and handed the baby back to Beth so she could peer from the window. It was a taxi, and as she watched, she saw her father step out and pass a £10 note to the driver. From the other side of the taxi, she saw the thin, pale legs of Kaylee, and the even thinner legs of Tia, and the bottom of a suitcase, and the handles of a pink gift bag. She pushed open the window and she hung over the ledge.
"Dad!" she called. "Kaylee! Come up to Mum's room. Come straight up. We're all here."
The end. You've been listening to The House We Grew Up In by Lisa Jewell, narrated by Karina Fernandez.
Want to find out more about Whole Story audiobooks? Visit us at www.wholestoryaudio.co.uk. Here you'll find hundreds of best-selling titles, together with sound clips, narrator profiles, author interviews, and much more. Alternatively, contact us using the details on the cover to receive updates on new releases. Whole Story Audiobooks. The whole story as the author intended.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this programme.